You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Currently, we are headed for horrible climate change or maybe climate catastrophe. Decades ago, we could have saved ourselves by stopping the use of fossil fuels. Now, even rapid decarbonization is not enough. Somehow, we have to recapture our previous emissions and store them safely away from the atmosphere. Some drastic geoengineering plans have been suggested, including darkening the sun with more pollution. A new paper investigates a less harmful way to capture carbon and help crop production at the same time. It has the blessing of James Hansen. From the University of Sheffield, UK, we have reached the lead author, Dr. David J. Beerling. He is a professor of natural sciences and director of the Leverhulme Center for Climate Change Mitigation. Beerling is the author of 200 papers and the best-selling book, The Emerald Planet, How Planets Changed Earth's History. We'll be talking about a big new paper titled Farming with Crops and Rocks to Address Global Climate, Food, and Soil Security. David Beerling, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What in your previous science life led you to investigate an agricultural solution for climate change?
That's an interesting question. I think every academic has their own career trajectory or goes on their own research journey. The first part of my research was really investigating how the evolution of terrestrial ecosystems affected atmospheric CO2 levels. So all the way back to the Paleozoic, so 400 million years ago, when we had tiny plants, through to the arrival of the great swamp forest in the Carboniferous, 300 million years ago, there was a 100 million year transition, and the CO2 at that time, we think, plummeted by about 90%. And there was a hypothesis that it was driven by the rise of deep-rooting trees and forests across the landscape. And so I spent quite a lot of time in my first part of my career investigating both the sort of theoretical aspects of that hypothesis, but also doing experiments. And then it became very apparent that I could translate this knowledge into trying to think about how we could accelerate weathering using crop plants as a way of capturing CO2.
Where did the idea of enhanced weathering to capture CO2, where did that come from?
So the idea of adding crushed rocks and minerals to soils has been around since about the 1980s. I think it was one of the first proponents was Olaf Schuling in the Netherlands. And I think, the idea sort of kicked around, but nobody had really sort of picked it up and run with it. And particularly, nobody had thought about doing it with cropland systems, agricultural systems. There were one or two reports in the literature, but I think our paper was the first to really pull all the different lines of evidence together and marshal the concept in a sort of coherent way and say, look, this could be done, and it's a very interesting way forward.
Well, as you say, rock weathering has modified climates in past ages. How does the speed of those natural processes compare to what we need now?
So the natural processes are really small. So today, the natural processes of rock weathering that are going on, they capture about 0.2, a fifth of a billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. And what we would be hoping to do would be to accelerate the process to the point where we're capturing maybe two or three gigatons or billion tons a year. So that's quite a significant increase.
It's my understanding, David, there are two types of CO2 capture with carbon-grabbing rock, and one is in the ocean and the second on land. Is that correct?
That's correct. So there are hypotheses that suggest if you put silicate rocks in the oceans, then they would weather and capture carbon. But, I mean, the issue for me with that is that you're sort of cutting out the middleman, which would be the croplands. And if there are these well-defined benefits that we explain in the paper, then why not have those benefits for crops to enhance food and soil security and capture carbon rather than just chuck all this material in the oceans? And I think that does raise a second point, which is very important and very topical at the moment, is that people are very sensitive, and the public is very sensitive, and rightly so, about us chucking billions of tons of rock into the oceans. And I think we've seen most recently about the problem with plastics and plastic pollution in the oceans, how the public responds so quickly and with alarm to that sort of situation. So I could see there being potential problems with introducing large amounts of rock directly into the oceans.
David, has anyone actually tested the cropland method you propose on land?
Yes, well, currently we are undertaking some large-scale trials with four-hectare plots that are being dosed with crushed basalt, and the plots are fully environmentally audited, and we're able to determine, or will be able to determine, not only the extent to which carbon capture is happening, but also the feedback on crop production and yields.
Well, let's try to dig a little deeper into this paper without drowning, because it's huge. There are just so many subjects encapsulated in it. But the crops, how do they play into this scheme for carbon capture?
So they play into it because the crops maintain root systems, and those root systems form symbiotic associations with fungi called mycorrhizae. And we know that when you add crushed rocks and minerals to soils, then the mycorrhizal fungi and the roots preferentially target those rocks to break them down to extract the trace nutrients that are present in there. So the crops and the rooting systems and the microbes directly play a role in accelerating the breakdown of the rock grains.
So I'm part of a gardening crew who have been putting rock dust on the gardens to get better plants. Now I'm thrilled to learn that I might eventually help a little bit with climate change.
For sure, and you know, there are reports in the literature that if you grow pumpkins, then adding silicate rock dust to the soil can improve protection against fungal diseases that pumpkins and those sort of squash type plants are very susceptible to. And one of the interesting features about using rock dust, as you probably already know, is that it's one of the few fertilizers you can use within organic agriculture. And that's one thing that we actually escaped in our paper, the realization that this could be promoted as an organic fertilizer for organic agriculture. And people are willing to pay a premium for organic agricultural products, so that might help with the economics of actually doing it.
What happens to ecosystems when the runoff from this added rock dust inevitably runs into the rivers?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, the honest answer is that's still under investigation. We know that as the minerals weather, they produce dissolved organic carbon and also a kind of very, very weak alkaline solution which drains into the rivers. Ultimately, that will drain into the surface oceans. And because it's weakly alkaline, it could help buffer ocean acidity caused by rising CO2. But what the direct consequences of that are on the biodiversity of river sediments and rivers themselves remains to be investigated.
So what's the end storage point for the carbon? Is it in the oceans? Is it in the soil? Where does it go?
Yeah, so there are two kind of main storage depots for the carbon. One would be the soil. It may precipitate out as carbonate in the first instance, and then in the longer instance you might form a dissolved bicarbonate, which flushes out through surface runoff into rivers and then into the oceans. Where it's stored in the oceans is dissolved organic carbon on a time scale of about 100,000 to a million years. And we know that the storage capacity of the oceans is huge. They already store more than 40 times the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, so we could easily tuck away our fossil fuels into the surface oceans and have very little impact.
And what sort of rocks work best for enhanced weathering?
So in an ideal world, what you want are very fast-reacting rocks, but it turns out these are called ultramafic rocks. But it turns out that these ultramafic rocks also have, or quite often have, high concentrations of metals like chromium and nickel that are toxic to plants. So you certainly wouldn't want to put those on your croplands that you're going to then eat the yields from. So what we suggest in the paper is that a better candidate rock might be basalt, which is left over from ancient volcanic eruptions and which is extremely abundant. Based on very large compendium of analyses, we find no evidence that it's got heavy metal contamination in there that would pose a problem to the human food chain.
Now, we're going to have to mine massive amounts of this rock. What happens to the ecosystems where that rock is mined? I mean, is this open pit mining? There must be impacts there.
Oh, sure. sure. That, so that really, you know, the amount of rock that you need at the global scale depends on the extent to which it's rolled out and the application rate, you know, per unit land area. And you know, our recent calculations, which haven't been published yet, suggest you might need 6 or 7 billion tons of rock a year annually if you were to apply it to, say, 50% of the most productive managed croplands of the world. Now, that sounds like a huge number until you realize that we're already producing between 7 and 18 billion tons of silicate waste from industrial processes. And so conceivably, if that material was suitable and that would require more research, then you could think about how we develop a kind of circular economy where we're recycling this material without doing any extra mining and still capturing carbon.
That's like steel mill waste, for example.
Yeah, so steel mill waste and construction and demolition waste, and also iron slag as well. So in the U.S., I think the U.S. has the earliest patent for putting processed slag onto weathered soils in Florida, which went back to about 1871, I think. And somewhere along the way, we kind of lost the will or the desire, or the economics wasn't right, and now we don't do that so much anymore. Perhaps with the arrival of the Haber-Bosch process and NPK fertilizers, we've forgotten what silicate rocks can do to replenish soils.
I found it in old agricultural books, which was kind of interesting, along with wood ash, of course, which they had plenty of in the day. Now, your paper also investigates erosion rates and soil loss. Why?
Well, one of the problems with modern agricultural farming is that because you're tilling the soil so much, you're basically causing the soil to turn over, the organic matter oxidizes, and then the soils sort of essentially blow away in the wind. And so we have a very significant global soil erosion problem. Now, if we were to start adding silicate rocks back, this would start to help rebuild agricultural soils in several different ways. One way is that as those silicate rocks weather, they produce clays, and the clays themselves increase the water-holding content of the soil, and they can also attract organic molecules, which then form very tightly bound organic carbon coatings around the clay grains, and this increases the soil organic carbon concentration of the soils. And so these two different routes, the increase in water retention and increase in soil organic carbon, plus the fact that they can stimulate microbial growth and the growth of mycorrhizal fungi, can all help to start rebuilding soils and reverse this kind of global problem of soil erosion.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock from the University of Sheffield. My guest is Professor David Bierling. We're talking about carbon farming with rock dust to help reduce climate change. I found an earlier paper on this subject titled The Potential of Enhanced Weathering in the UK. It's by Philip Renforth, who was then at Oxford Geoengineering Program. I didn't know they had one, but they do. And he attempted to calculate the economic cost of large-scale enhanced weathering. Does your paper look into the cost, and if not, why not?
The paper doesn't deal with costs, and in fact, economic analysis of how much it might cost is something that our group is currently working on very intensively. Without giving too much away from our unpublished work, I would say that Phil's estimates are probably not too far away. One of the things that we're interested in doing a sort of global calculation for costs is figuring out, first of all, how much electricity is required to grind the rocks into a fine powder to increase their reactive surface area. And to do that, you need to know the different mix of energy sources by each nation and also the intensity of CO2 emitted by each of those energy sources. And then you also need to know the price of electricity for each nation. So it becomes quite an involved calculation. That's just the grinding side of it. If you're going to distribute your rocks, you need to know globally what the cost of diesel is and how many miles you're doing. So there's different layers of that calculation, and it was beyond the scope of the paper that we've just published, but it's something that we're working on for our next paper.
To be clear, what you propose is geoengineering, isn't it?
I would say, in a sense, I think the scientific community is moving more away from classifying approaches that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as geoengineering. The National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. prefers to call these sorts of techniques, you know, climate intervention, because they feel that the word engineering implies a degree of precision and certainty that's unwarranted with the, with these approaches. Other people might call it adaptation. You know, we're adapting how we grow our crops to capture carbon and reduce usage of agrochemicals would be another way to think about it. I hesitate to classify it as geoengineering.
All right, and your paper says almost 11% of the land on Earth is used for crop production, and that's a stunning area. I didn't know it was that large. I presume that's enough to capture the carbon we need?
Well, it's important to recognize that even if we could deploy it on 15 million kilometers squared of croplands, it wouldn't be economical, and B, you wouldn't want to do that anyway because there are areas where it's highly productive and warm and very conducive to weathering. But I think, you know, the bigger issue is that in order to solve the climate change problem, we're going to need a portfolio of options for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And there's no one approach that's going to take all of it out to help us get to our climate targets that were discussed in Paris a couple of years ago. We really need a portfolio of options, and I would say at the moment it's too early to take any particular option off the table, and we should pursue research in all of these different areas.
Where would be the best places, David Buehring, to begin this program, perhaps to test it out on a large scale with the least carbon emissions given out?
Well, somewhere where they have, you know, somewhere, for example, like Brazil, where you have a warm climate, and that's coupled with a large land area where they use, which they use to grow a bioenergy crop, a sugar cane, and those crops are grown on heavily weathered soils that are typically acidic, and they require high inputs of expensive fertilizers that are very intense, require a lot of energy to produce. And they have a lot of co-located basalt reserves in that region. So, you know, from a sort of economic point of view, and also from a sort of practical standpoint, Brazil might be a very nice target country to begin to undertake these sorts of studies.
I noticed throughout the paper we find a list of big questions in a wide variety of sciences that need more research. You've mentioned a couple here in the interview. Given the pace of science and science funding, that could take a decade or two. Do we have that time?
Well, I think in order to persuade policymakers that this is something worth doing, then we need to establish the evidence base. And doing science takes time. You know, doing good science takes time. And, you know, the reality is that if we're going to limit future climate change, we need not only to curb our emissions, but also develop approaches for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. Now, the lead-in time for some of these approaches may be longer than others, and there are, you know, low-hanging fruit that were identified by earlier work where, for example, you know, we should undergo aggressive programs of afforestation and reforestation in particular regions, which would at least begin to capture carbon and buy us time whilst the research in some of these other areas progresses.
In a press release from Columbia University, James Hansen endorsed this method of carbon capture, and I see he is also a co-author. What role did Hansen play in this research? Was he an advisor? Did he read through the paper?
Oh, Jim was closely involved in it. He was one of the first people to recognize, you know, the importance of actually undertaking research on negative emissions technologies or carbon dioxide removal approaches. And Jim was very helpful in helping us frame some of the questions, particularly in relation to climate change and how it could contribute to climate change mitigation in a way that was robust and also, you know, posed questions for policymakers.
But I noticed that, as a botanist, which you are, a well-known botanist, you also have the interest in feeding the world as the population grows and our croplands, as you've noted, may shrink due to rising seas. So there's that second driver for you beyond climate, isn't there?
That's right. I think the challenge of feeding, you know, 9 million people in 2050 is about trying to produce more food on existing land, managing our resources more efficiently, rather than chopping down more tropical forests. And, you know, if we can develop approaches that increase food production whilst at the same time making that more sustainable for the environment, then I think that's the way forward.
Given the need that we all recognize to save ourselves from an extreme climate shift, do you and your team think that enhanced weathering through soil supplements is the best chance we have?
Well, as I said earlier, I feel that we need a portfolio of options. And some of them are what you might call technology ready, the low-tech ones like afforestation and reforestation. Some of them are more controversial. And I feel that this particular approach is unique in that not only does it offer opportunities for improving food and soil security, but it might also offer approaches for mitigating against ocean acidification. Not many of the other approaches have that unique combination of selling points.
So where do we go from here? How do we develop this carbon capture technology?
So the next steps are really to, as we sort of discussed earlier, is to think a little bit in a lot more detail about the economics for this and actually what it would involve for each nation, what fraction of their GDP would be involved. We need to do a lot more work on figuring out how much carbon this system could capture. I think, you know, the economics and the amount of carbon the approach could capture are very important. And then I think, you know, the third point is thinking about field trials. You know, we really need to go out in the field and investigate how this operates in the real world. It's okay having models in model world, but really what we need to know is how does it work in reality? And that's one of the things that the Leverhulme Center is doing, is undertaking field trials, both in the U.S. with the University of Illinois with Champaign-Urbana, but also in Malaysia and also in Australia. So we can really connect, join the dots between doing experimental work and doing modeling work and actually seeing what happens in the field.
We are running out of time, and that's a shame because I really would love to dive into your book, The Emerald Planet, How Plants Changed Earth's History. I've been reading up how trees began, the first development of cellulose, and as you talked about, their march across the planet and changing the atmosphere. Perhaps we can talk about that another time.
For sure. I'd be delighted to discuss it.
Cool. I'll look forward to that. We've been speaking with Dr. David Bierling from the University of Sheffield in the UK. After groundbreaking research into the climate of deep time and 200 published papers, David is now the lead author of a broad new paper titled Farming with Crops and Rocks to Address Global Climate, Food, and Soil Security that was published in Nature Plants in February 2018. You can find links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.